morning, wake up, wake. Good morning, wake up, wake. Good morning, wake up, wake. Wake up and get yourself to church, yeah. Welcome again to CDA Live. We're so excited to introduce Rob DeSantis, my friend of over 20 years now. And the more I got to know him, the more interesting he became to me. And I thought it'd be great to share that with anybody else in our circle of influence, telling his story, which is really interesting on so many levels. So thank you, Rob, for coming and making the time. You happen to be here, maybe due to COVID, so that's pretty neat.
Yeah, thanks, Spencer. Yeah, I'm usually on the West Coast, but I've been here extra long this summer.
Yeah,
and enjoying it.
Well, thank you so much to grab a little piece of your time, which I know is very valuable. I'd like to just start with, How did this all come about? I know a little bit about your family, but how are you, kind of, where'd you grow up? Kind of what formed your early childhood? What sort of brought you from your average kid like we all started off to, what did you pick up over those early years?
Yeah, well, I was locally born and raised here right in on Aquidneck Island. Had a great childhood, a great family, a large family. Nothing too special, just as you said, just a normal life growing up. And I think the takeaways that I got is my father worked very hard. He had a full-time job as a draftsman and then engineer in Raytheon. And then he'd work on weekends and evenings doing odds and ends construction jobs to make some extra money. And then my mom, she went out and got a job as a bank teller. So we had just a normal middle-class life, Little League, what have you.
And in Portsmouth?
In Portsmouth, okay. Yeah, born and raised in Portsmouth. Graduated Portsmouth High School. School always came easy to me.
Yeah.
I didn't even realize, I never really tracked my grades. I just always liked to do well. I don't even remember taking much homework home, but when I talked to my parents, they said, you know, I would do a little bit, but I always made sure I got my work done. But yeah. I graduated, I think, fifth in my class at Portsmouth High of class of 275 kids.
How about sports? Were you into sports at that age?
I was into sports, yeah. I transferred from baseball to tennis when I got to high school, and I really got into tennis. I was on the tennis team all 4 years. We won the state championship, I believe, my sophomore year, and I was a captain in both my junior and senior year.
Nice. So you had a little taste of the sporting world at that time. We'll talk about that a little bit more as we get going, but tell us about college and what happened. Where'd you go to school?
What's the story? Well, I went to school at the University of Rhode Island as a mechanical engineer. Went to school in 4 years, and so all I did was study and work hard, and I got good grades. I graduated third in my class as a mechanical engineer, but I really didn't use that time to explore all different elements of life. I just did my work and kept my head down. The best thing that happened to me in my college career was my girlfriend and I split up in my 2 weeks or 2 months before I graduated.
Whoa.
And I had to make a decision. I'd already accepted a job locally here in town, at Raytheon in Portsmouth.
Which is where your dad was?
Which is where my dad had been, to be a mechanical engineer. But I really, it didn't feel right. So I sent some resumes out to Silicon Valley, out to California, and I got a job offer for Hughes Aircraft Company to be an aerospace engineer.
Wow, right out of college.
Right out of college. Yes. So I packed my bags up here, right out of school, and into my car, drove out there. I got crop dusted in Arizona. My air conditioning went out, in Arkansas, and got out there and started work.
So you drove cross country a week long.
It was
by yourself.
By myself.
Wow.
Yeah, by myself.
That's a long time to think.
Yeah, it was a long time to think. New life in front of me. I got out there and I quickly realized, as an engineer at Hughes, I remember I was very bored after 3 months. I was like, oh my gosh. And
Is this it?
And my office mate was 75 years old. He was a contractor. And he goes, this is your life, buddy boy. For the next 50 years, you're going to be doing exactly this, sitting in this desk. And I was like, oh my God, I can't do this. So then I was trying to think, what am I gonna do differently? Keep in mind, the internet wasn't around. This was back in 1985. But I was reading the LA Times one day and it said, earn $10,000 a month part-time. And I said, well, shoot, I can do that. So let me go do that while I'm doing my job at Hughes. And then once I'm doing well, I can drop the job at Hughes.
Yeah.
So I went in and learned it was selling Herbalife, which was nothing wrong with the product. But the way you sell it was you had to put 1,000 flyers out every night on cars.
And Herbalife is what?
Herbalife was a vitamin that said that would help people lose weight and get healthier.
Okay.
So I would put 1,000 flyers out every night at the local mall and play the numbers games for them to get calls. And then I would also go to supermarkets and I'd go up to people who were overweight and I'd say to them, how would you like to lose weight and make money? And I got chased out of so many supermarkets.
Did anyone take you up on it?
From the supermarkets, no.
I wonder why.
I think that's because I was 22 years old, thinking, well, surely people who...
Someone wants to do someone, this.
Yeah, so I don't know. It was crazy.
Oh, man.
So I did that for like 6 months.
Gave you some chops in sales, though, I'm sure, right?
It did.
With no's.
Well, I knew after like a month, I go, I need a testimonial. Yeah. So I talked to my grandmother back here in town at the time, and I bought her some, and I gave her it, and she lost 10 pounds in 1 week.
Oh, boy.
And I was like, God, there we go. I've got my testimonial. But I never really had much success. So I think I sold 2 or 3 customers in 6 months. Just then, one of my friends said to me, Rob, forget that Herbalife stuff. How about we go become stockbrokers and sell stocks and bonds? The stock market's really hot.
Boom.
It was early 1987, and I thought, well, sure, let me go ahead and try doing that. So I got my Series 7 license as a broker at night.
Just magically? No, okay. Yeah, you did the study, right?
I signed up, I signed up and studied, and then I went to go get a job as a stockbroker. But I went and visited all of the brokerage houses, that was in itself a sales job, just to be able to get into the branch managers, being a 22-year-old kid with no network and no wealth behind you. And when I did get them, they all said the same thing to me. They would say, kid, you're not from around here, number one. You have no book of network of people with wealth. And you're an engineer, and engineers aren't really known for talking to people all that well. Yeah. So you know what? We're gonna pass. Yeah. Until finally I got to this one branch manager at Drexel Burnham during the Michael Milken junk bond years. And I said to him, look, I know I'm an engineer, I know I have a book, but I'm gonna work harder than everyone else. So what I did was in 1987, in the spring of 87, I got up every day at 4 a.m. Got to downtown LA by 5 o'clock in the morning. I had to listen to the stock ticker because there was no internet, to hear all the stock recommendations coming from New York, write those down, read the Wall Street Journal cover to cover, 5:30 to 6, new broker meeting 6 to 6:30, where I had to present the stuff on the stock ticker. Mm-hmm. And at 6:30, we started our cold calls. So we do our cold calls from 6:30 to 7:30. And then at 7:30, I jump in my car, drive to Hughes Aircraft Company, do my engineering thing for 9 hours.
Jeez.
Then I jump back in the car right after that and drive back, grab some fast food on the way, and then I do cold calling from 6 o'clock till 10 o'clock at night, and then I do it all the next day.
Oh my gosh. How long did you keep that up?
I did that for about 6 months.
Oh my gosh.
And then the stock market crash came in 87, and the movie Wall Street came out. And Martin Sheen was doing essentially what I was doing. I'm like, I don't want to do this. I can't do this anymore. So one of the engineers at Hughes, the contractor, the 75-year-old contractor, said, if you really like selling that much, why don't you sell something that you're good at?
Yeah.
And that's engineering software.
There you go.
And I thought, there's such a thing? And
what were you using to engineer up to that point? Was it a hand?
Some of it was hand calculations, but there was a lot of software programming at the time, doing structural analysis. So so I got a job a couple months later by this USC professor-owned structural analysis company.
Okay.
and him and his evil daughter.
The plot thickens.
The plot thickens, yes. Because I got in, and right away, I'm like, oh my God, I don't get chased out of grocery stores.
Yeah, that's so much better.
I don't get people slamming the phone on me. They actually want to talk to me when I talk to them, and I know what I'm talking about. So wow. I could actually demonstrate the software yeah. and show how good it was, and then I was Perfect. Started making sales.
You got your sales and engineering combined.
Yeah, now the big thing on this one was this was my first 100% commission job. So when I quit Hughes to go do this job, it was...
Before you started, it was...
Before I started. I've never done sales before. I was all in. Zero cash coming in, 100% sales. My parents are worried that what was I doing, giving up, leaving the mothership of Hughes with all that great benefits. And I did that. And I got 3 months into it when I thought the commission checks were going to start coming in. But the evil daughter, who she ran sales there, she would say, hey, Rob, I'm taking your sales right now. I go, what do you mean you're taking my sales?
You're 100% commission.
I'm 100% commission. She goes, yeah, that's right. She goes, but I'm pregnant and I'm moving in another 6 months. And she said, if you are still around in 6 months, you will be able to keep your own commissions. Oh, but until then, those commissions are mine. I could see that I was really good at what I was doing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I stuck it out and she left and my income transitioned. Just to give you a rough idea of the magnitude of change, I was making $30,000 a year as an engineer at Hughes.
Yep.
And 6 months later, I was making $300,000 a year.
That's a nice bump. And that was just LA area or you were all over the place?
I was selling. I was inside sales okay. over the phone.
So people are calling you?
No, people weren't calling me. No. What we do is we ran ads in Mechanical Engineering magazine, and they would reply, be interested. So we got these things, they call them bingo leads. And I would just call them up, and then I started talking about them. And then they would be looking at five or six different software systems. So I had to convince them that mine was the best and what have you. So that's what I did. So I was covering the whole West Coast.
You're selling software. You're running up and down the West Coast, and then I know that you went to Europe for a little bit. I think that's a pretty interesting story. So how did you transition? You're in LA, and then what happens?
So I was in LA and selling for that company, and I got recruited to my first Silicon Valley venture capital-backed company that was selling the next generation of this structural engineering software.
Okay. So it's same field, different company.
Same field, different company.
Got it.
And I applied all the techniques that I'd learned from Drexel and Herbalife. And in the first 3 months of this company shipping product, I sold 40 systems, and the other two sales guys that were at the company sold zero. So they asked me to move to Silicon Valley and build a national sales organization. So I did, and I spent the next couple of years building a national sales organization. When I was about 26 years old, I was working on the budget for the following year, and I was only getting 50% of the budget, but I was responsible for 90% of the revenue that the company was going to generate. Mm. I said, well, why is that? Why does international get so much more revenue than
the budget
if they're not making the money? And they said, well, Rob, you don't understand. You're too young. You don't understand what it's like to sell abroad. So I said, well, okay. And move me there.
Challenge accepted.
Challenge accepted. And then from there, I moved to Europe. We had what we called at the time a Geschäftsführer in Germany. So I moved to Germany, where Germany was the company's headquarters for all of Europe. But anyway, I ended up doing business in 33 countries there. And I was pretty happy. In 6 months, got the revenue of Europe caught up to that of the United States. And I hadn't even realized that there were 33 countries in Europe at the time, but I became much more educated in that. That company, we were getting ready to go public and we got bought out. Mm. So we got bought out by a Boston-based company here called Parametric Technology. So I moved back to Silicon Valley from Europe and started working in the venture capital community for about a year or so, looking at different opportunities, trying to figure out what my next move would be.
Okay.
And then in 1996, a sales guy who had worked for me, he came up with the idea of Ariba.
Okay.
And Ariba was a company that I was a co-founder of with him and five other guys. what he did. His name was Paul. Paul came to me with the idea.
Which was what?
Which is such a simple idea. He said, hey, Rob, when we receive purchase orders at our old company, how did we receive them? And I said, what do you mean, how did we receive them? We got them fax or hard copy. He said, yeah. What do you think with this new world of the internet? Don't you think it'll be handled a lot differently, maybe with email? I said, oh, yeah, but big software companies, they'll be doing that. We can't catch them. And he said, no, these big software companies, they're working on old code, old technology, and they're all focused on manufacturing goods. But if we focus maybe on office supplies and furniture and computers and all the things that people need.
Household goods.
To run their good. He says they call it MRO, maintenance, repair, and operations. And he says, we could build a great company. So I said, well, let's build an 8-slide PowerPoint and see if we can go sell it. So we built an
8-slide. You're good at selling. Yeah. We'll try it out.
So we built an 8-slide PowerPoint, and we went to several large companies in Silicon Valley, and we pitched them the idea and acted as though we had the company. And they were like, oh, my God, that could save us a tremendous amount of money.
But you didn't have the company.
I didn't have the company. They said, yeah. They said, can we see a demonstration? So each time we said, yes, we are just in the process of getting ready to do demonstrations. We'll get back in touch with you.
Oh, all right.
Which was great. We then, from there, we then took the next 60 days to go fill out the rest of our founding group. We were able to raise $6 million in 2 days.
Yeah, wow.
And we did that, and I ran sales, and I did this thing I put together, later coined a rebithology, which was a way to create a sense of urgency and scarcity as a young company, in a way for companies to, in order to get companies to not only want to buy a product, but buy a product before it's released. Hmm. So as a result, 8 months into the company being founded, we closed over $2 million worth of business. We're a new company. We know we can save you tens of millions of dollars because we put together an ROI model with the customers. Mm-hmm. And we said, but we can only help 4 companies save tens of millions of dollars in our first year.
Yeah.
So
scarcity.
We have an application for you to fill out as customers. But the only thing about that, Mr. Customer, is you're going to have to prepay us up front. And so I said, because we're going to go off and hire 1 engineer and 1 professional service person to make sure you're successful.
Okay. Off we need the money to get that going.
And so, so we got the money to get that going. And
they basically paid for your ramp up costs.
We find it
which
out.
Normally you don't. You got to go find that somewhere and then get ramped up. So
then the other interesting thing is here we are, June of 1997. We're now cash flow positive. Mm-hmm. We'd raised $6 million, and we had over $8 million in our bank account. And so what we said was, now is the time to go raise money.
Yeah.
Because it's always good to raise money when you don't need it.
Yeah.
We showed momentum. We had closed 4 major large enterprises, Bristol-Myers Squibb, FedEx, Visa, Cisco Systems.
Okay, those are big.
Those are big big names, and people were getting really excited, and we had kept, and we had educated the market as to the market segment that we were going after. Mm-hmm. And so we raised another $20 million at a $125 million valuation, and gave ourselves a war chest of over $30 million to go really build and ramp the company. So over the next couple of years, we took the company from zero to $250 million a year in annual revenue, zero to 3,000 employees.
Wow.
After 3 years, I again moved to Europe, because I'd done Europe before I knew how to do it. So this time I moved to the Netherlands, which is a little bit more neutral from the big three big markets.
Yeah, yeah.
And I penetrated some very large accounts, and a short time Philips became a multi-million dollar account within 6 months of me getting out there. And I built the European and Japanese and Asian organizations while I was in Europe. And then we went public in 1999. And we were about $80 million in revenue. Mm. The following year, we were 3,000 employees and $250 million in revenue.
Oh my gosh.
And
that's staggering growth in just a short amount of time.
Yeah. You know, we had a great team, but bigger than the great team is we had incredible cultural values.
Oh,
we said, check your egos at the door.
Yeah.
Hire people better than yourselves.
Yeah.
We'll be a team first, functional specialist second.
Okay.
And be prepared to play musical chairs. Because we would tell everyone in the company to go, your value in the company after 6 months
yeah.
is more important than the functional value. So we may take someone from sales and put them in product management, someone from engineering and put them in product marketing and demonstrations. Yeah. We're gonna move people around and play musical chairs that want to, of course, so that everyone gets this broad base of knowledge and growth, and at the same time, are able to, not only are able to grow people, but we're able to build the organization by having other, these new spots to fill. We hired the first 100 people, I think, without any recruiters.
And how?
Every A-plus person, we used to say, knows five other great people.
Okay.
So if every person knows five other great people, then every time you hire someone, that's another five great people to go hire.
You can...
And it would be amazing because engineers knew of great salespeople. Salespeople knew great engineers. Finance people knew great people. I mean, it was just all one cohesive team.
Wow.
So we were able to build. We did bring in a recruiter to work as an employee into the company full time, just to be able to manage the process of
of
interviewing, hiring, and retaining all these people, as well as our HR department. But it was.
It must have been exciting.
Ariba was a machine. It was a machine. And even today, 25 years later from the company's, or 24 years later, today a little known secret is if you take all of the transactions of Amazon and Alibaba and combine them, Ariba still beats them. Ariba conducts more transactions on the internet than any other system in the world.
Wow.
And
Well, that's pretty wild.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So towards the summer of 2000, I found myself, it was a Sunday afternoon. I was 37 years old. I was in the Forbes 40 under 40. I was 25 pounds overweight. I was sitting in a conference room in New Jersey, and I was being told how the rest of my Sunday afternoon was going to be by a 28-year-old product manager from a Fortune 100 company, and all I wanted to do was play beach volleyball. I had spent my time at Hughes at Manhattan Beach, and I just, which was ground zero for beach volleyball.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, I had an epiphany. I go, I'm 37 years old. I'm not taking care of my body. I have no children.
Mm.
I have no balance in my life.
Mm.
And I said, we are 3,000 employees going to 10,000. Surely I must not be needed for every moment of every day, 7 days a week. And so I went back to I flew back that Monday rather than staying out in the field. I flew back and met with the CEO, which was also one of the co-founders, and said, Keith, I need to take some time off and go have some kids and get my life in balance. So
What are some of the things that you, I mean, you obviously got success pretty early. Is there anything that you think of, like high level, that you could pass on to people that separated, you know, your sales? You led teams, you led international teams, you went up by your bootstraps asking grocery store ladies if they wanted to be thin and rich. What are some of the basics of the things that would help anybody starting running in a company in their sales side?
I think of two things that come to my mind. First one is time management. And the way I've done it in all my career, in my professional career, is I've created time boxes. I think proactively about my day. And I think, what are the things that I want to get done? Because in life, a day, you can lose the whole day to just reacting to everyone else's requests and stuff.
Sure.
So what I would do is I get up each morning and I proactively think, what is it that I want to accomplish today? I review what I want to accomplish for the week.
Yep.
I think about when and how I'm going to do that. And then I start my day.
Okay.
And
okay.
So, for example, in sales, I knew that when I was selling engineering software, I knew that engineers typically get in early. They typically like to get work 7 to 4 as opposed to 8 to 5.
Mm-hmm.
So I would do all my cold calling between 7 and 8 a.m. I made sure I was in my office and I had my cup of coffee at 6:45 a.m. I wasn't having coffee at 7 because that's the right time to be calling.
Yeah.
And I would get through all my cold calls and I would get in touch with so many people. Where the average salesman would come in about 8:30, get on the phone. By that time, they're not getting through to anyone because everyone's off in their meetings.
They're busy, yeah.
So that's how I would time it. Then I had all of my follow-up meetings between 8 and 10. And then I had my other stuff between 11 and 12. And then I would always do my, if I was going to go see a customer, I would, or a prospect, I would do it in the afternoon. And I would ruthlessly qualify that person, because I could make so many more phone calls if I stayed in my office. Mm. So that for me to go out and be face to face with a customer, I need to know that that customer was a real qualified opportunity.
Right.
The second thing is I learned it early in my career, selling through curiosity.
Okay.
So the average salesman, from my years of experience in hiring people, so many of them, they go out and they want to show up and throw up. They want to get up and show you their presentation, tell you about all the features and benefits of whatever they're selling is better, faster, cheaper. Mm-hmm. The way we sold, we didn't have a presentation. We would ask 5 questions.
All right.
We would say, ask the customer, what's their current situation? So how do you currently, for example, I'll use Ariba. How do you currently buy things? What do you like about how you buy things?
Okay.
What do you dislike? What would be the ideal solution? What would be the attributes of the ideal solution? Mm-hmm. And if you had that ideal solution, what would be the value? What would it be worth? I mean, mm-hmm. can you quantify it?
Yeah.
So the typical customer with Ariba would say, oh, we buy stuff, we have to get a purchase requisition, it goes through all this routing and approval, it goes to managers, it takes forever to buy. What do you like about it? Oh, our controller likes it because nothing gets bought, because
yeah.
it's so hard to buy something. What do you dislike? Oh, it's hard to use, you never know what the approval chain is, you never know this. What would be the ideal? Oh, it would be online, you could see the chain of command, you could see how fast it would take,
you
could
see the pre-negotiation.
And then what I would do is I'd be writing all this down on a big whiteboard right in front of the customers.
Okay.
And then I'd say, if you had a solution like that, what would it be worth? They said, oh, if we had a solution like that, if we were able to go to Home Staples or Office Depot and say, hey, we're going to funnel all of our spend to you, or at least a large chunk, what type of discounts would you give us if we made you one of our key suppliers? Mm-hmm. They say, oh, we'll give you an additional 5 or 10%. So we said, oh, so you could save 5 or 10% additional. Yes. And how much do you buy each year? Oh, we're a large company. We buy about $40 million worth of stuff like that each year. Yeah. Oh, so you could save 5 or 10%. You could save anywhere from 2 to 4 million. They mm-hmm. go, yeah, but that's just one commodity. That's just office supplies. On furniture, we could save another, blah, blah, blah. So then they would say to me, they said, all right, so can you tell us about Ariba? And then I'd say, I would love to tell you about Ariba. See this whiteboard? This is Ariba. We went out to companies like you.
Yeah.
We asked them those same questions, same as I asked you. They told us the attributes mm-hmm. that they wanted. We listened. We collected that list. We took that giant list. And we formed a product.
Got it.
And delivered that.
Wow.
So selling through curiosity. That was taught to me.
They were saying yes before they even knew it, right? It was their idea.
That's right. So there's a gentleman named Barry Ryan and Associates that he had taught that at this previous company that I worked at. And give him the credit. He teaches the course now at Stanford.
Well, I thought it was interesting that 25 years ago, you still remember the core values of your original company. As a business owner who's trying to navigate all that stuff and reading books about core values, pretty telling that you started this amazing company and you still know the core values off the top of your head.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah.
So tell us about life after that sale. You left, you were overweight, as you said, or a little bit overweight, and you were time to do family stuff. So tell us kind of that transition to...
Well, I was very fortunate. We went public, and being an officer in a company, you had to have pre-planned sales so that you don't get sued if the stock goes up too fast or down too fast or anything like that. So I was able to financially move into a total different wealth status during the couple of years post Ariba's IPO and prior to the dot-com explosion. So I was financially set. I was very curious to say, I don't want to assume that I know what it's like to be wealthy. So I was very fortunate I kept asking different financial advisors that were coming at me. I said, I'm going to give my money to someone to manage who can help me learn how to be wealthy. Okay. So I was introduced to this group called Money, Meaning, and Choices. And they said, they talked to me and they said, you know, Rob, most people spend their life chasing two things, money and time. Once you've achieved the ability, the money and the time, then the question is, what do you do with your life? They were able to take me through a process to say, what are you going to do now? And at the time I said, oh, I'll be CEO of another Silicon Valley startup and maybe someday be a venture capitalist. And they said, are you going to do that because that's just there? Or is that a proactive decision on your part? And I said, that's a good point. Yeah. So I went and explored that with them and identified maybe seven other things that I wanted to explore in life before I just went on to keep doing my Silicon Valley thing.
Yeah, right.
And so I used a period of about 3 or 4 years to rebalance my life, to check out those things professionally, number one, to have kids, number two. Mm-hmm. Today I'm happy to say I have a whole boatload of kids. So I have kids and I have some really nice balance with some of my personal activities such as beach volleyball and golf.
Right.
And I rode my bike across country
I'd love to hear a little bit about your sporting stuff. I mean, we've played all sorts of games, fun stuff. I love beach volleyball. I love biking and golf. And so to do those with you, you're about 10 years older than I am, shorter than I am, but beach volleyball is a tall man's game, and you kill everybody that you play with. It's so amazing. I'm really fascinated with mindset issues. So your mindset, maybe you took it out of growing up, maybe it was from the work stuff, but then you seem to apply that to your athletic pursuits as well, which is really fascinating to me because I'm just as a junkie jock as you are. So
thanks. It's funny you say that because what I did is, after I retired from Ariba, I was so used to my mind going a million miles an hour and where and how to apply that. A third of my time was spent professionally. I ended up getting hooked up with LinkedIn when they were 2 weeks old and investing, and I was on the board of LinkedIn. So I did that and then other companies along the way over the past 20 years. And then, so that was a third of my time, but that what didn't consume, my brain was like a race car, wanted to race. Then there was another third for the family. Yeah. And I was keeping busy doing all the family stuff.
Yeah.
But the third that I probably got an unbelievable satisfaction out was in sports and activities. I, unlike so many people that I envied, didn't have the time or the effort, either as a child or as a young adult, to really do the sports the way I liked it.
Yeah.
And in fact, I just thought about this. It's something worth mentioning. When I was 24 years old, I was rather bummed out I hadn't grown up learning some of these sports and that I wasn't at the top of my game on those sports. And also that I really wasn't financially where I wanted to be. Mm. So I came up with this idea in my mind. I go, okay, Rob, the way I was going to try and tolerate my lack my frustration of my life when I was 22, 23, was I said, okay, I'm going to come up with themes. My 20s is going to be for exploration. My 30s is going to be about making money. My 40s is going to be about family. And my 50s is going to be about fun. And my 60s will be some combination.
we'll figure that out.
And I thought about that in the back of my mind. And wouldn't you know,
that's
exactly what happened. The other thing that happened when I was 20.
I want that too.
The other thing that happened to me when I was 23 years old, at the same moment when I was reflecting, I said, I'm going to go focus right now on making money. Mm. Because that's the one thing that I know I have to do in order to reach my life goals. So I'm going to go do that and I'm going to work really hard and hopefully someday I can start a business and I'm going to try and retire by the time I'm 40 years old. Because if I can retire by the time I'm 40, all these volleyball players that I'm watching every weekend, these professional volleyball players, they're going to be just retiring as they're getting 40 because they were about the same age as me.
Okay.
And I said, and maybe I can become a mentor for them in business,
okay,
and they can become a mentor for me in volleyball.
Oh, there you go.
And wouldn't you know,
that's
really what happened. And it happened for volleyball, it just happened for golf, it's happened for tennis, it happened for cycling.
When did you ride across the country?
So I went in 2002, I retired in 2000, and in 2001, a good friend of mine is here in Boston said to me, Rob, you want the most intense type A lifestyle experience that can never be realized unless you do it? I said, what's that? I said, bike across country. So
A biker?
I was a little bit of a biker. I'd done some 100-mile bike rides through the Solvang Century and this that. But this time I said, okay. So I said, well, let's do it. So I hooked up with a company called Crossroads that was based out of Connecticut at the time. And 40 of us started from Manhattan Beach and we finished in Boston 49 days later.
Wow.
42 days of riding, a day off like every 7 or 8 days.
Okay.
Roughly about 100 miles a day.
100 miles a day, so centuries every day.
Yeah, centuries every day.
Is your body just getting crushed?
The first couple of weeks, your body's crushed. The big thing is your sit bones.
Yeah.
Even though you train a lot, nothing trains you for that much every day.
Yeah.
And when you're going through Arizona, it's 118 degrees out, and you're sweating, and your sit bones are sitting on your saddle, you get these big blisters.
Oh.
And so I remember riding 2 days totally standing up on my bike.
Wow.
And not sitting down. Every time I sit down, I remembered it. I remember going through Dalhart, Texas,
yeah,
a cattle country of the year. I was dehydrated, went to the hospital that night, thinking that I knew something was wrong with me. The physician assistant on the side gave me whatever he gave me was wrong, and my heart stopped.
Whoa.
And so they had to jumpstart me back up. And they jumpstarted me back up.
Get back on your bike.
And I was out of it. I didn't know. I wake up at like 10 o'clock the next morning. And then I jumped on the bike at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
In 100-degree weather. Not feeling all that great.
Slightly.
And I biked. I biked in. I got in at like 9:45 at night.
Yeah.
Everyone there cheering me on. And then continued on the ride and finished the ride.
And your body just sort of figures it out?
Yeah. I mean, believe it or not, after 2 or 3 weeks, your body turns into a machine. Toughest part of the ride was the mental capacity of knowing that you were going to be on that bike 8 hours a day. When we first taken off, they go, 40 of you starting out on this ride, statistically, 33 of you will finish. And we're like, what's going to happen to the other seven? And they said, the other seven, you'll be either attacked by a dog, get into a car accident, your body will just give out and you won't be able to do it.
Yeah.
And we're like, attacked by a dog? Well, they said, as soon as you get past Palm Springs and until you get to Ohio, they go, we're going through lots of farm and ranch land. And lots of these people have 2 or 3 Dobermans, Rottweilers, you name it.
That are just wandering.
They go, the best defense is your water bottle. They go, if you have mace, don't worry. They get you down by the time the mace counts.
Okay.
You're not going to carry a gun. You ain't going to carry a knife. A knife has got you down. So it's not going to. They go, the water bottle, if you squirt right at the right time, will cause them to rear up because they're not expecting it. And then you can get away. So you're like, the only thing that's going to protect me is my water bottle? Oh, my God. And they go, you'll find normal cadences of 3 or 4 people that you end up riding with. But boy, you never want to be the first or last. Oh. Boy, it was a tough thing.
Oh man!
But I got it done. It was an absolute fabulous experience, and we lost about 6 people.
Yeah.
But
okay.
No one got killed. Just
good.
Broken collarbones.
Yeah. Or something. Messed up. Wow. Well, so tell us about. I mean, we've had some cool discussions about family, and you've got a unique family experience with some older kids, and now some newborns, really. And what you've learned, as we're sharing our lives during these, that's one of the neat things is to sort of cover, what you're doing professionally and the personal side. So tell us about like the second family, young kids. And
well, the thing I've learned, regardless of my first batch of kids or my second batch of kids, is I feel very blessed and grateful for my life, that I've had the opportunity to be so engaged with my children. And my biggest recommendation to all parents, and the thing, my lessons learned, is be engaged with your kids and enjoy the journey, enjoy the moments. I enjoy reliving Mary Poppins, reliving, you know, all those first experiences with the kids, and just enjoying the miracle of life. And I find that the key is to enjoy every age and stage.
Sure.
And you see that every age and stage requires you to live through them, requires you to educate them, and be engaged with them, and love them, and be loved. And you know, the second time around, I've learned, you know, for me, for example, I've got from all my bike riding, I've got a bad neck,
and it's
kind of challenging me for me leaning over a tub trying to wash the kids and stuff like that. And I want to make sure that I'm healthy and engaged with the kids through all their life. So my wife takes the lead on giving the kids a bath and stuff like that. So just learning the different things that we can do and stuff like that.
Well, just meeting all your kids and seeing how curious. It's cool that you mentioned that you're curious, because that's what I get when I think about you. You're just curious about everything. When we're dealing with architectural things, you're just curious, how does this work? How does this go together? Maybe it's your mechanical engineering side sort of rearing up, but you have that genuineness that I think you're talking about in like true sales, not just putting on a used car salesman gig, but you're interested in the other person and interested in how it all goes together. And everybody wants to be around someone like yourself.
Well, thank you. That was a big thing that I learned differently about, you know, I never, and most universities and schools really don't even give sales.
They don't talk about it at all.
They don't talk sales as a profession.
It's a huge part of life.
Sales is like the number one, sales is what makes the world go round.
Yeah.
And when people think about it, they think of the old negative used car salesman
approach.
But sales is a true profession.
Yeah.
And they really are. I used to say to my salespeople, you are the mini CEOs of the company. You have to know about product. You have to know about delivery. You have to know the customer's issues and sensitivities. You need to be able to know our internal issues and sensitivities. You need to carry yourself. You are mini executive of the company. And there's such a interesting flavor of the profession of sales. The second thing that I learned, going back to your family question, and actually relevant even in the sales, is how you start determines how you finish. And I'll give you an example. The example that I'm now working on with my younger children are, when they're 2 years old, you don't really think, oh, let them have that extra this, or let them have this extra treat, or let them, they want this, and you think, okay, I'm just gonna, all these little asks that they have, I'll just give them to them. If you give them all these little asks, A, it could become spoiled, but also you're not teaching them that there are rules, there's structure, and stuff like that. And if you catch it when they're 2 years old versus when they're 8 years old, you get a much bigger issue or problem. So to me, I'm really enjoying the second time around, really fine-tuning,
watching
that vector that they're on.
Yeah,
I was very fortunate that I was very engaged in the first. My older children are just super fantastic.
Yeah.
I can't. What can I say? But that's it for the kids. So other than that, the family's good. The sports are great. The beach volleyball, as you talked about earlier.
Man. I've been so fortunate.
Good. As you know, I've had you out there training with Eric Fenoy. I've had the last opportunity for the last 10 years to play with one of the Olympic gold medalists on a weekly basis, Eric Fenoy and Moana.
Yeah.
And then play with all these other retired and current pros. I played 2 years ago in this dinosaur tournament with Taylor Crabb. In fact, he's going to be out here next week, and I'm going to play some ping pong and golf with him,
but
he's playing in the Olympics in Japan next year, and I played with him as my partner in a tournament, and then I played with Sean Rosenthal, a two-time Olympian, and it's been great to be able to do some of these things. You know, you asked earlier what kind of led me to be able to do some of these things at such a competitive level, and the thing I tell people, it's been an open mind. I've kept a real open mind to I've never been afraid to disassemble my game and relearn from people better than I.
Okay.
And that's helped me in golf and tennis and biking and
yeah.
And any sport that I've been doing.
Segue to all of life, right? If you can really be humble enough to say, I'm willing to just trash everything to pursue a better path. You know, you can jump some levels there if you're willing to do that, but it's really hard, right? You always want to cling to what you know, and you were mentioning golf buddies who were really good and they're sort of plateauing. Meanwhile, you're, you know, continuing on because of your mindset.
When I first started golf, seriously, 10 years ago, these guys were like 7-8 handicaps, and I was like, wow, these guys are amazing golfers.
Yeah.
And then as I took lessons and I really honed my skills, you know, applied all some of that those Ariba cycles to my retired life, I found I was just as excited and really learning about the emotional, technical, mechanical skills of the game. And as a result, today I'm on my way to, I'm almost a low single digit. I'm a 6 handicap
wow.
now.
Yeah.
And
amazing.
And I really get inspired every day to get up and try doing that better and more. Same thing with my volleyball, and as we'll go play some later today.
Yeah, I can't wait. So just finally, I'd like to just, for folks that are listening and are probably in the entrepreneurial realm for the most part, what do you've seen and been part of and been on the boards now for 20-something years, either creating your own company or in analyzing other companies or seeing startups. What's your advice to a scrappy young entrepreneur who's like wants it really bad but's not sure, like some of the baseline things that you think sort of go from business to business is sort of applicable to all realms?
Well, one is passion. You gotta have a passion for what you're trying to build.
Sure.
And the only way you can really get passionate, I believe, is if you believe what you're doing is delivering value, whether it's better, faster, cheaper, or a combination of the three. And then when you get passionate about those things, then you can communicate that with that same level of passion, and you can build, whether it's building your company, whether it's hiring employees, whether it's selling the message to customers or partners. What I find most of the time is the devil is in the details for getting success. You know, some people said it with Ariba. They said, oh, right place, right time, the internet. No, it really was all of the details that got us the success that we got when we did and how we captured it. Yes, we were in a great market at the right time.
Right.
But it was those details. And one of the best things that we had with Ariba was none of us came from the world of purchasing, so we had to be open-minded and we had to be curious.
Yeah, right.
And we had to ask questions. So curiosity, open-mindedness, delivering value, have passion. Those would be the things that I would give.
If I could maybe ask you that, it seems like you've always looked to coaches, which seems like something that someone who's humble would do versus saying, I know how to do this, I'm going to just rip into it. But you seem like, I always hear you talk about, well, I had a mentor here, I had a coach here, I hired this person. Is that part of it? Just opening yourself up and getting that feedback so you have something to open your mind to?
Yeah, very much so. I have, in every discipline of life, I've always looked for mentors or coaches to help me. And then I have enjoyed over the past 20 years doing the same. I both receive and I get.
Well, thank you so much, Rob. I think there's a lot in here for all of us to unpack. And I'm just so grateful that I consider you my friend and we've shared lives together up to this point, from design work to life experiences to playing volleyball tournaments together and golf and the whole thing. So I just, your friendship to me has been really a sweet spot in my whole life, and I'm pretty grateful for it. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Spencer. Same thing.